feel alive, let's hit the dance floor. Don't work too hard, might break a backbone. Return of the Mac, the king is back though. Corvette and cash, I never lack those. Shimmy, shimmy, yeah, I got the semi-fold weight. Don't step out the line like this a probate. You hit the line and try to locate. This for the time, got time for no day war.
Welcome to another edition of the Crow Nose Podcast. We're going to be talking all things private aviation today, sales, charter, give you guys all the goods and the inside info. I am joined by the Leviate Air team. Thank you for joining us. Luis Barros, Rob Rosenberg, Randall Mize. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Good. Thanks for having us.
Great. This is one of the most popular topics, not only for business owners, people in the business community, but for everybody. It's just one of those things that everybody wants to know more of. It's not always easy to get information and to learn more about it, so everybody gets super excited about it. So I'm looking forward to talking about a few different things here when it comes to private aviation. I want to start with charter, though. Obviously, we know coming out of COVID, every industry got turned upside down. We know a lot of things, you know, went just to the moon. Some things have stabilized. Some things have stayed there. So broad scale state of the charter market 2024 compared to how it has been, say, 2021, 2022.
Yeah, you know, I'll take that. And, you know, like you said, COVID was kind of a game changer for us. I think Rob and I always remember the first week after, you know, everything kind of slowed down and came to a halt. And we were looking at the tracking board of all the aircraft in the U.S. and it was zero over zero. It was literally the quietest, most eerie we've ever seen it in the industry. Literally not one takeoff, not one landing, except for, you know, emergency aircraft, that sort of thing. But what happened immediately thereafter was a game changer for us. It opened up this huge piece of the market that, you know, was there. They just never utilized business aviation. And afterwards, they never went back. So it was big for us. It was good. It's starting to, you know, kind of right itself a little bit from that big, big surge. But it's still at all-time highs, doing very well. People are really making use of private travel.
So the people that are, you said, hey, it's opened up a big market for us. A lot of people that hadn't done it before are starting to get into charter. They realize the value in it. What does the customer look like? Or I should say, who was the customer historically pre-COVID? And then now, who is your who's your avatar customer now in 2024 for charter?
Yeah, I would say, you know, pre-COVID, you probably had, you know, as far as our company is concerned, probably more of the business individual. They were either using it more for business type charters, or that specific executive, you know, if he was doing trips with his family, they would book personally with us as well. And then I would say after COVID, due to, you know, everything being more sanitized and worrying about being on a, you know, commercial airline and things like that, you probably had more of your, you know, regular, I guess, civilian, you know, more families, things like that, that, you know, maybe they were flying first class before, but now they're like, you know, just protection of the family, things that are going on, you know, let's splurge a little bit more and we can actually fly privately.
Yeah, and keep in mind, the during COVID and post-COVID, there was a lot of new wealth generated, a lot of younger wealth generated over those years. So the average, you know, demographic for our key customers went down from, you know, call it mid-50s to lower 60s, all the way down to lower 40s, maybe even high 30s in age, which was a great shift for us because, you know, that just opened up a huge piece for us.
I think in addition to that, AJ, the dynamic of private travel changed in COVID as well, because most viewed it as a luxury, and even family offices and high net worth people would say, you know what, I'm just going to go first class. Well, that mindset changed to say, you know, I'm not going first class to my home on the East Coast or the West Coast because it's not safe. I'm going to travel privately in a small aircraft with just my family that's clean and safe, and I'm willing to pay a premium to do that. And once they got used to that, like Lewis said earlier, there was no turning back, because once you experience private travel, it's really difficult to go back onto the airlines.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think so we know, obviously, there was this explosion, right? We know it's now started to increase, but a lot of things that we look at from a macro perspective, interest rates obviously come to mind, of things that impact the charter market, which I'm sure is a little bit different than what impacts the sale of aircraft. But talk to us a little bit about, what are you guys seeing right now that specifically is impacting the charter market in 2024?
Yeah, so I can speak to at least the charter side of it. You know, the good thing is no one's really financing their private travel, their charter trips. They better not be.
Right.
We really hope they're not.
If they are, yeah.
But no, what we did see, you know, there was a lot a lot more people that were, like Randall said, just it was something they couldn't justify before, and after COVID, it just became a necessity. It was almost a foregone conclusion that they were going to travel private if they had the means. And it just turns out there were a lot of people that had the means, they just never justified it. So for us, it was very good. Yeah, as far as interest rates and whatever that's been doing the last year or two, it didn't really have much of an impact on charter, because if anything, charter just kept seeing more and more demand.
Are you guys seeing much of a difference between business and personal charter? Is one outperforming relative to the other, or outperforming their own historical categories and the business or personal, or are they both pretty much, you know, running concurrently?
I think, like Rob mentioned earlier, you know, business travel has always been there. It continues to be there, you know, for us pre-pandemic, post-pandemic. We saw the huge surge in leisure travel. And if anything is kind of right-sizing right now, it is on the leisure side of it, wouldn't you say, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, I'd also say as far as, you know, value goes, you know, an average charter trip that we sell is typically $20,000 to $25,000. And then, you know, on the business side, if you have executives that, you know, need to fly across the pond or things like that, obviously the value of those trips are a little higher. So we get a combination of both. But yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think we're still seeing strong activity, whether it's business or personal.
So I think a lot of people probably struggle with, you know, is private chartering, is it right for me, right? So what would you guys say? And I know it's a difficult question to ask, but I do want to give people some idea of, you know, for the people that are like, I could never do this, right? I should never do this, right? Either it's too expensive or whatever it is. But who do you guys typically see as your average customer that maybe one of these customers that you said have come to you guys over these last couple of years that all of a sudden were opened up to it? Who is that customer usually? Is it you know, your small business owner that's doing, you know, a couple million in EBITDA? Is it, you know, an executive that you mentioned more on the corporate travel side? Who are you guys seeing now as the customer that's been almost most surprised to get into this world?
Yeah, and I think we hit on it a little bit earlier, but as far as the business travel side is concerned, where people see the most value is the time and savings convenience. You know, Randall likes to call it a time machine. If you have a small business owner, like you said, a few million to maybe 10 million to get them in the door of EBITDA, if they're traveling to these secondary markets, these secondary locations where commercial travel is going to take them a full day or maybe even a day and a half, these guys can get in and out, host multiple cities or hold multiple meetings in multiple cities, and conduct 2-3 times the amount of business they could otherwise. On the business side, that is our key client. That's who's really seeing the value of private aviation.
Yeah, and one of the things that we do a lot is, you know, that business executive, he might fly across the pond first class, but then if they're doing an IPO or something like that, and they've got to hit multiple cities or multiple, you know, countries in Europe and things like that, we're saving them so much time by them being able to fly privately and being able to get that exposure versus sitting in an airport for 2-3 hours at a time before they hop on the next flight.
Yeah,
I think just to add to that, I mean, everyone knows this, right? Private travel is hard to justify. But at a certain level, it's very justifiable. And like he said, they are time machines. And we have clients that say, since I bought the aircraft, I've done 10 million, 20 million more a year in sales than I would have done otherwise because I've hit so many more locations. Doesn't apply to everyone. I think there are those people that just have done well enough that they can justify it because of their high net worth.
Sure.
So everything's relative, right? If I have $100 million, I'm okay to spend $1 million a year on charter.
Yeah.
So
I'm sure there's a lot of stories of people that may say, hey, I would have missed out on closing a certain deal if I would have had to go from point to point to point to be able to get where I need to get to.
Well, yeah, for sure. You also have these extreme situations of where the only way to do the trip is charter. There could be a death in the family. There could be something that's come up super quick and they can't get there via the airlines. And we do see that too. And we call them ASAP trips. And someone says, I have to be there in 5 hours and I can't make it on the airlines. And this is critical for a family reason or a health reason, or it could be any number of reasons. I mean, we fly organs too. So some of our chartered business is actually cargo and organs, which sometimes the organ has a certain amount of, you know, time that it could be out of the body, and there's all these rules, and so private is the only way to go.
Yeah,
I think recently we've seen a big increase in those trips as well.
Yeah, and keep in mind, it's not, I think when people think of private jet travel, they're just imagining a big G650,
sure,
spending $500,000,
yeah,
you know, to go to Paris for the night.
Yeah.
Now, even us, I mean, we've taken advantage of private travel. We've taken Randall, it was your connection with the PC 12, a Pilatus, because we just needed a full day in Amarillo. So just to get to Amarillo first thing in the morning, host a few events. It was at a rodeo championship that we were sponsoring, do some events. I think we also did a podcast that day. We knocked out a full day's work, and we were back in Dallas for dinner.
Yeah.
So it's people really don't need to have that misconception that it's huge aircraft going overseas all the time.
You can charter a single engine turboprop.
Yeah.
We're those guys.
Yeah.
We are not the jet charter guys. Okay? Yeah. Although we sell those trips, we're not riding around in private jets, so don't get fooled here. Okay? Yeah.
Well, so. I do think it's like a lot of, I think there's a lot of industries that are like that where people have the perception. And I think a lot of the negative perception is, hey, everybody is, you know, riding the big Gulf Streams and they're polluting the environment, they're killing, you know, these are big wasteful trips, or they're going from, it always makes noise whenever Kardashian flies from, you know, two airports within LA or something, gets a hold of that. And so, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and it's really funny that you bring that up. We actually have a client right now on an aircraft that's based in Farmingdale in New York, and very green conscious, so carbon offset's very important. You know, this particular individual could own any type of aircraft that they wanted, and he specifically has a smaller category aircraft because of that. You know, he doesn't want to be flying in a G650 that you know maybe puts out more carbon offset than something else. But on the other hand, it's other people. It's just their personal preference and also what they need for their specific mission.
We are. I'm glad you brought that up because we are seeing a shift in mentality as far as carbon offset. That particular person is a billionaire, and they're riding in a small aircraft, stopping multiple times to get their home in LA solely for fuel consumption. Mm-hmm. So I think as we go forward, that becomes more and more important to many people, and either buying off carbon offsets or SAS fuel or building more efficient machines is going to become more important to the business jet industry.
Yeah, and we attend Corporate Jet Investor every year in Miami. Randall's and Lewis have been to the one in London as well. And you know, the OEMs, when they get up there, and the first thing they're talking about these days is building the equipment that supports all of that. So it's a very pressing topic in our industry as far as the growth and future of building, you know.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the headlines too, they like to villainize, you know, private jets and private travel, where it's really the opposite. These OEMs, these manufacturers of private jets, they're investing just hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in things like Randall mentioned, sustainable aviation fuel, you know, just all these great investments that trickle down to other parts of the industry. And private aviation is really, you know, spearheading that movement. Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's private aviation is probably a big driver. If you didn't have these people, because it's more of a, you know, personal investment rather than a large company investment, a lot of times these people that are really focused on this kind of thing that are demanding it is probably driving a lot of these manufacturers that they may not have in the past.
Sure, absolutely.
So I think that's a good opportunity to pivot and talk about blending both charter and private. Or owning an aircraft and some of those other options as well. You guys obviously do all three of those, broker, sale, and manage as well. Talk to us a little bit about what that evolution looks like. We were talking earlier about there's almost this, seemingly this evolution of you know, how people finally get to buying their own plane. But talk to us a little bit about what that evolution usually looks like.
Yeah. You know, we see this, and because we do have our own aviation ecosystem, as we call it, we can see the full life cycle of a private aviation customer at Leviate. But really, anyone that just wants to try private travel, they're going to charter. You know, they just want pay-as-you-go, one trip, one aircraft. If they like it, they can do it again, or they can try another aircraft on the next trip. If they're taking the family to the Bahamas, you know, for Christmas, you know, they can get a bigger plane versus if they're just taking a day trip for business to Oklahoma City. So that's good. And after a while, if people start taking it, you know, what would you say, 150 hours, 100 hours a year, even they're going to say, okay, per hour, you know, charter's not the cheapest way to go. Or maybe they have a tax offset that they need in a certain year. They'll start looking at, you know, putting up some capital to acquire an aircraft.
Yeah, I can build off that real quick because obviously the natural progression is to try something before you buy it, right? Mm-hmm. So your charter customer, entry level, you go fly around for a couple different trips, and the next question in most people's mind is, okay, this is amazing, how do I get one of these? And so we actually have a transition team in-house, and we analyze people's mission profile, and then we build analysis based on where they're going, how many people they're taking, and then we come up with recommendations on what aircraft would fit their mission best. And at the end of the day, AJ, it's not emotional, it's a math equation, right? So the buyers can get emotional about it and say, I want an airplane, but we can run the math and say, hey, doesn't make sense yet from a financial perspective, but we're happy to help buy you an airplane. That actually happens a lot. And they say, you know what, we know it, but we want our own pilots and we want to buy a plane and we're okay if it costs a little more than charter. But there's a delta where you reach where owning an aircraft makes more sense than chartering. And generally, like Lewis said, 100, 150 hours of a year. If you're flying that much and you're committed to flying private for those trips, then you have to consider ownership. And there's not, you know, for multiple reasons. Number one, it would be cheaper. Number two, there's tax offsets. So if you're bringing in $10 million a year and you buy a $5 million plane, you can follow the current tax code and you can depreciate it. And so you actually have huge tax savings by doing that. 100% bonus is gone, but you can still depreciate 60% this year, and then you follow a 7 or 5 year MACRS after that. So there's huge tax reasons to do it. Just the comfort of having your own crew. When you're chartering, it could be a new pilot every time, right? And of course, we vet the operators and they're safe and all that. But some people say, if I'm gonna do this all the time, I want my guys and girls up right. front. I want to know these are my crew and that's my airplane and I know how it's been maintained.
Yeah, and so. Especially when you have the family dynamic come in as well. You know, they're gonna be around your kids, you know, your wife, your husband, whoever. They wanna interview the pilots, interview the flight attendant. They wanna know that they are now kind of a small part of your family as well because they're traveling your family. They have lives in their hands. So they want a really intimate, you know, connection with their flight crews.
And we've actually had the trifecta happen at Leviate a couple times where it started with one of our charter brokers, had a long-term client. They were spending X amount of dollars a year, flying a lot of hours. Then we looked at, you know, the economics and it made sense for them to start looking at acquiring an aircraft. So we hand it off to Randall's team on the aircraft sales and acquisition side. Then they take over from there, start dealing with the client, find them the right aircraft. And then after that, that person also wanted us to charter the aircraft when they weren't using it to help offset a lot of their costs. And we were able to keep everything in-house. So we had a charter client, ended up acquiring an aircraft, and then Leviate managed the aircraft for them as well. Yeah. So that's the full natural progression within our company.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you mentioned the tax, and obviously not tax advice, anything that we talk about on here. Consult your tax professional. But we're in an election year, and I know a lot of people, when it comes to major purchases like this, CapEx investments, things like that, there's always a little bit of maybe more hesitancy on it's an election year, what's going to happen? Is 100% going to come back, right? I know it's been on the table a little bit, maybe it's off. How are you guys seeing customers handle this specific, you know, election year? Are they pulling back a little bit, saying, let's see how the dust settles? Or are they continuing to work the same way on the acquisition side?
I think it's fair to say that the market has pulled back a little bit. I think a lot of buyers are on the sideline for a couple of reasons. One, you mentioned the politics of things. People don't like uncertainty, and so let's wait and see what happens. Two is interest rates. So a lot of people are saying, you know what, I have this very thing. This guy gave us a retainer, signed a contract, and then he said, time out, let's press pause. I'm gonna wait a year. I think the interest rates are gonna come down. I'm not paying 7%. Let's wait for 4, and I'll just charter in the short term. So we are seeing people sit on the sidelines for political reasons and for financial, you know, financing reasons. So
yeah, and it happens every election year. Every election year, you see it. It's like any deployment of capital. You know, the private equity markets see it. The M&A markets dried up. Same thing here. People making large purchases, they wait. They want to wait and see what happens. So it's good and bad for us because we have all different segments of the market. But we can just wait, and afterwards, it's like clockwork. You always see a big boom after the election.
One thing I want to add, though, is that although we are seeing a pullback and a pause, markets remain strong. So we've watched inventory levels slowly rise in the world market throughout the last year, year to date. You know, we started the year out at roughly 5%. You know, if there's, I don't know, 20 something thousand business jets, you've got a normal stable market is 10% for sale. So we started the year at 5%. We're at maybe 6.5%, 7% now. Pre-COVID, we were 10%, 11%. So we're not even close to where we were. In some premium markets, you know, 10 years or newer aircraft, inventory levels are still around 4% and 5%. But then you have some older markets like the G4 and the G200. The G200 is the worst market out there right now. It's at 17%. So those older, slightly older aircraft have been impacted much more intensely by the by the things we just mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And the premium markets remain completely stable, and part of that is because the OEMs are sold out for 2 years. If I want to buy a brand new Phenom 300E from Embraer, I can't do it. They're on back order for a year, so then I have to go to the pre-owned market.
Is there a shift outside of just, hey, this doesn't exist anymore, or it's too hard to get? Is there a shift, I'd say both on the charter side and on the purchase side, is there a shift in what consumers are looking for in terms of aircraft type?
On the charter side, it's not so much aircraft type, but it's more about the YOM, the manufacturer date of that aircraft. So you have certain clients, especially if they travel a lot with their family, they might say, hey, I only want to be on a 2010 or newer. Mm-hmm. But as far as the aircraft type, it's kind of, you know, if we present something that it's safe, it's maintained, it's, you know, had a pretty recent refurb date, that's fine. It's just typically...
Yeah.
Hey, if I've got my whole group on here, I want to make sure that it's at least a 2010.
Well, and I want to go into that a little more, because I think a lot of people, first of all, would be very surprised if they knew the age of the aircraft that they were flying on every day.
Exactly.
On the commercial side.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people that think, hey, they may say, hey, nothing before 2010, right? Because they may think it's like a car that goes. Talk to us a little bit about, like, what is, you know, the average age of an aircraft in the charter market? Take one of your... you know, one of your standard routes, and I know standard is probably an annoying term to use, but just something to give listeners a little bit of an idea of like what is realistic, so that when they come to you guys and say, okay, this is the aircraft that they're put on, it's not a big surprise, right? Is it something in the, you know, a 1998 is a very normal year to see? What does that look like?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny you mentioned the year, because aircraft are based on a completely different metric. They're based on hours,
right?
And hours flown. And if you're right, if people knew, you know, because aircraft are such maintenance intense and I guess regulated, or I should say monitored machines, you can have a 25-year-old aircraft that is just running rock solid and just as safe, you know, as a 10-year-old aircraft or 5-year-old aircraft, depending on how well it's been maintained over its lifespan. I know from a demand standpoint on charter, people generally, the most sought after is 10 years or newer. Mm-hmm. Even the biggest purchasers of charter, your Wheels Up, your Sentience, your you know, NetJets Vista when they're going off-fleet, a lot of the metric is just 10 years or newer. It has to be 10 years or newer. On the other end of it, most charter clients don't want anything older than 20 years. So that's kind of that sweet spot between 10 and 20. But yeah, if people knew, you know, it's really more about hours. You know, you don't want to see some 20,000 hour aircraft or some 15,000 hour aircraft out there flying you around. That's what you should really be concerned about.
And it's also certain, you know, safety steps that we take, you know, we do in-house with our team. You know, we train them, and, you know, there's Argus Gold, Argus Platinum, is Bayo Stage 1, Stage 2. So, you know, we got to make sure that the fleet that we're putting our clients on, that they adhere to certain, you know, safety protocol that we have in-house. We get trip checks on crews, make sure they have X amount of hours. The, you know, the PIC has, you know, a whole bunch of hours. The SIC meets the minimum requirements, and then we're able to pass that on to our clients as well.
Randall, on the purchase side, what should, I think charters, there's a little more comfort in just knowing, mm-hmm. you know, something you guys are putting together is gonna be good. From the purchase side, if somebody's just going out looking and trying to figure out, you know, early stages, what are some things that they should be looking for so that they don't get sucked? Obviously, you want to use a professional to go through something like this, but what are some things that you guys are looking for that are some quick, you know, quick run through rubric to use to say, okay, this is, you know, this is a solid option?
Yeah, I'll finish the aircraft age, because I think it's important. Like an aircraft 40 years old. You know, 30 years old, kind of old. 20 years old, we're okay. 10 years old's pretty nice. 5 years old is basically new, right? Yeah. So I think that kind of gives you, if it was made in the 70s, early 80s, we're pretty old.
Right.
People are flying around in aircraft that are built in the 70s. I don't see a lot of 60s aircraft anymore. Mm-hmm. Aircraft start retiring when they get to a certain number of hours, and people start getting uncomfortable with that old of an aircraft. And then as far as like things, if we're gonna go buy an aircraft, what you said is really important. I need a qualified person to help me look at all the things so that I'm protected. This is a huge purchase, and you would be shocked about how many high net worth people try and do it themselves mm-hmm. without not knowing much about markets or aircraft in general. And part of that problem is our own created problem in the industry. There is no certification process to be mm-hmm. an aircraft broker. Would you like to be a broker? You can be. Get your cell phone and computer out, and then go talk to a high net worth person and sell them a plane.
Yeah.
So I can't cut your hair without a license, but I can sell you a $60 million asset. Makes no sense. But that's the world we live in. So our industry is self-regulated itself. There's a body called IATA, International Aircraft Dealers Association, and it's a huge organization, and it's really important because it's trying to change the way that the industry works, and it's holding itself accountable to certain standards. And buyers are now starting to recognize that organization and say, wait a minute, is the guy I'm working with an IATA certified broker? And if the answer is no, then they're probably a lot more skeptical about who they're dealing with. Not everyone is one, but that's just a way to know that you're working with a qualified broker. So that's the first step. Make sure that who's representing you knows what they're doing, has a lot of transactions under their belt, and it takes more than one person to protect a buyer on a purchase. What's the maintenance history? Where has it been maintained? Are the logbooks in English and complete? The logbooks on a plane, and you don't really have this in a car, but when you have an airplane, you have a group of books that everything that happens to that airplane is notated in these books, basically like the Bible of the aircraft, for lack of a better word. And if half of that Bible is missing, then the half that value of that aircraft is missing. Mm-hmm. That's how critical these books are. So when you buy it, you make sure that it's been well maintained at places that you know, and not, you know, Bob's, you know, shop over here that no one knows anybody. And did he even do the maintenance, or did they just pay him and he pencil whipped it? I don't know. So that's important. Where has it been maintained? Are the records complete? Does it have any damage history? That is a very dangerous word in our industry. And it's not unlike cars. You know, Carfax, if you're in a car accident, the value of your car is less. Same with aircraft. Although what high net worth people can do is if my wing runs into a side of a hangar, I can replace the winglet with a new winglet and it's not damage history. But if I repair that winglet, then I have a diminution of value of 10-20% of the asset value. So it's really important to understand how the airplane is maintained and if it's had any accidents or incidents, how that was handled.
What are you guys seeing generally everyone always hears the term starter home, right? 3-bed, 2-bath, something like that, 1,800 square foot. Is there such thing as a starter plane?
Entry level, right, is what we call King Air.
Yeah.
So first of all, there's entry level aircraft, but I would say also it's completely budget driven, right?
Sure.
Like we mentioned earlier, you can buy a 30-year-old Gulfstream heavy jet for $3 million, but it's going to cost you $3 million a year to maintain it.
Yeah.
But if I want to buy a brand new Cirrus Vision jet that, you know, only seats 4 or 5 people, well, that's $4 or $5 million. Mm-hmm. But so I think a lot of people, if they're an owner pilot, they start out in a Cessna or a Cirrus, and then they work their way up to, you know, a light jet or a turboprop. And then generally everyone's always wanting to upgrade to something bigger, right?
Yeah.
So I would say it depends on the budget.
Yeah.
So are we buying new or are we buying something a little bit older? But the answer is yes, there's entry-level aircraft.
Yeah, the other thing that comes up all the time is direct operating costs versus what your capital outlay is going to be on an asset. So some individuals might say, well, I don't care to spend $10 million on the asset. Whatever my direct operating costs are, they are. It's fine. But then you have other folks that care more about what is it actually costing me as the owner of the aircraft to fly per hour. So they care more about that than spending, you know, $10 million on the machine and maybe get something a little less.
Yeah.
I think that's important because the older the machine, generally speaking, more maintenance. So new aircraft, lower operating cost. Older aircraft, more maintenance, more operating cost.
But very rare that somebody's, for their very first aircraft that they ever own, is going to say, hey, Randall, I want you guys to look at a G650 for me. You know, that's very rare.
Yeah. Almost never happens. Yeah. They're starting in midsize. We have seen it where someone buys a large cabin first. But it's very rare. Almost everyone starts in light jet or midsize.
So I think a lot of people would be surprised generally to see how affordable in quotes is that you can buy an airplane for. Like we mentioned, you can buy a very nice plane for a couple million bucks, right?
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't realize how much on average goes in on the maintenance side. You mentioned the operating cost and things that go into that. How do you guys approach that that balance, right, between purchase price, operating costs? I know everybody's a little bit different, but are there things that maybe clients are more surprised by when they get to the table and realize, oh, okay, this isn't just, you know, $2 million and then a couple hundred thousand a year, it's more than that? How does that usually go?
Yeah, I mean, I think a really good example, we're talking about, you know, the delta between charter and aircraft ownership. That's what's so cool about the Part 135 air carrier. I can give you some numbers and example. We have a person that bought a $5 million plane, 20% down. They financed it, and you know, they were spending $5,000-$6,000 an hour to charter a plane. They use it 100 hours a year. We charter it 400 hours a year, and we drove that cost down to about $200,000 a year. That's $2,000 an hour. So what I care about as a high net worth person is, okay, I got to put 20% down. I understand that. I'm writing the $5 million off of my taxes. That's awesome. Now you're telling me I can fly my own airplane with the tax offset, and I can fly 100 hours a year for $2,000 an hour. I'm in.
Yeah.
And so if we can get in front of that person that has that $30, $40, $50 million net worth, I'm just using that as an example, that's okay with a $5 million purchase, we can make their all-in annual exposure on cost pretty low.
And it's called, our market intelligence team, you know, on the aircraft sales and acquisition side, they created a program called LOFT, which is Leviate Operating Financial Terminal, and that's exactly the plug-and-play system that of all the numbers that Randall just mentioned. So we can put it in that system when we're in front of a prospect and show them, if you fly 100 owner hours, this is what it's gonna be, and 400 of charter hours, and show them exactly what that, you know, offset's gonna be at the end of the year. So they have a very good idea at the end of the year what their true expenses are gonna be.
One thing that we've recently started doing, because people would say, well, that sounds great, but we don't really, you know, we don't know if you can actually do 400 hours a year, and so what if you don't? Okay, well, we'll write into the contract, we're gonna guarantee it. So if we do 350, we're gonna pay you for the additional 50 hours, and so that'll be, that risk is on us.
Yeah.
And once we started doing that, we had a lot more people signing up, and those people are in our program right now.
So. And I think it's important to point out that what the situation you just described, which is a really, really good mm-hmm. outcome, is still a cost of $200,000. And I highlight that because
yes.
we're in this guru world where people are gonna put on social media that you can hack your jet and fly for free, and that is not
no.
what you're telling me is that is not the case.
No, people, and I know that is a misconception. I'm gonna buy a plane, I'm gonna charter it, and it's gonna make money. Nobody's figured out how to make that work other than Berkshire Hathaway. So if you see all these startups out there, everyone's buying airplanes to fly them to make money, and they're all failing. And I could name off about 10 right now.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's incredibly hard to buy an aircraft and make money with it. Look at the airlines. I mean, even them scheduled yep. air carriers, for a lot of times when fuel would go up, airlines are all reporting losses. So how are we going to make it work with one business jet? They've got hundreds.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a funny thing. Again, most people don't realize that most airlines don't make money flying yeah. passengers. They make money selling miles to credit card companies. you hit something there that I do think is important, because I think a lot of people have a lot of hesitancy because, like you mentioned, the industry overall is filled with, you know, some negativity, right? People mm-hmm. have some fear about, you know, who are these players? Who are they? How can I trust them, right? We see a lot of these charter operators, especially, that have gone out of business pretty abruptly. I think most people in your shoes and most people that are really in tune with it generally can see, when they look at a business model, this doesn't really make sense. I don't know how this is gonna last. I don't know if I wanna give my money up front to somebody to hold it mm-hmm. because I don't see how it's going to be safe there. But for you guys, and I want to talk about Leviate in a little more detail. We've mentioned a couple things, but what really sets a charter broker apart, so that it, you know, potential clients and people that are looking can, when they're doing their own due diligence, can look and say, okay, this is a trusted operator.
Yeah. So on the charter side, it's almost like Randall said on the aircraft sales. Broker side, you know, you don't need to be, you know, certified. There's no sort of school you go to and graduate from to become an air charter broker. There really should be. So a lot of it is these sort of voluntary accreditations you can get for aircraft sales. It's things like IATA. For us, you know, it's Argus Broker. It's the Wyvern Leadership Program we just got into. It's a lot of these third-party things that you can do to go show that you're putting up some time, resources, some effort. To show the industry that you are a knowledgeable player in this space. Another thing to look for is some of the back house staff. Like he said, a charter broker can just be one guy with a cell phone and a laptop. That doesn't mean they're not knowledgeable and they may not have a ton of experience, but once you get to a certain size and you have a certain, you know, critical mass of clientele, you're gonna need help. You're gonna need operational staff. That's a lot. You know, I mean, you have people on full-time staff, benefits, overhead, office space, software, you know, you have a lot of people that are there to support your clients.
I want to drill down a little more. I apologize for interrupting, but I think a lot of people would have a misconception when you're talking about a lot of staff and overhead and employees for support, a lot of people will associate that with kind of like car dealerships, and they see the big flashy car dealerships like, all right, my service is going to pay in for this big flashy setup. But I think specifically in this, when we're talking about Charter, talk to us a little more about what those support staff do, you know, when things are in a pinch or if somebody cancels, things like that, so that potential customers have more comfort and understanding of why you guys have all those employees and what they're doing for those customers.
Yeah, and keep in mind, a lot of this is about bandwidth as well. I mean, these are machines with moving parts. You know, things like mechanical interruptions, they're going to happen. You know, and a lot of the nature of why people spend this premium on Charter is because it's, you know, it's on demand. It's when you need it. It's on your schedule. So if things do go, you know, wrong, or there is some sort of delay or interruption, you want as many hands on deck to help you recover, help, you know, make a very speedy recovery, quality options, know that you're not just getting hosed with something way overpriced because it's the only option that's out there. If you have a dedicated full-time staff that's there to support you, I mean, you can, it's a peace of mind sort of thing that, yes, this is the best outcome for the situation I'm in. And it's just, you know, it really goes a long way to know that you have 10 hands on deck instead of one or two.
So part of what you're asking is trip support. So we have an in-house trip support staff. So the broker will book the flight, but he's not handling ground transportation or catering or anything like that. He's focused on crew, safety, those types of things. But then trip support will pick up, you know, anything that high net worth person, charter customer wants, that group handles. Could be concert tickets, could be anything. We kind of go above and beyond to support our clients, because sometimes we have some odd requests. I'm on the way to Vegas and they can email from the plane, right? Everyone has Wi-Fi and we need tickets to this show. We didn't have time to book them. We've done that kind of thing before. And so, you know, when we started in 2014, this was the company. And today I think we have 55 employees across the three different companies. So, you know, it's been interesting over the last few years. And I would say, you know, we've probably doubled in size since COVID. I think that's pretty fair to say, so.
And then on the air carrier side, which is the fleet that we manage, you've got to have certain positions to be FAA compliant, right? So we have a director of operations, we have a director of maintenance, we have two maintenance controllers, chief inspector. What else is there?
Yeah, we have maintenance techs, we have dispatch, and these are positions that are overseen by the FAA and signed off on by the FAA. So it's really not a group that you can fake it till you make it.
Yeah. What's great about that is that all these people are located in the same office, so charter brokers can speak to our director of operations and say, hey, I'm dealing with this interesting situation. They're telling me that this airplane can't go into this runway because it's 5,000 feet. He can check with our own flight operations and they can say, you know what, that makes sense. Or wait a minute, something else is going on here. Is there weather? Is it raining? You know, so we as a team have all these resources that we wouldn't have if we were just a brokerage or just an aircraft sales company or just a 135 air carrier. So
yeah. Give us the origin story. How did you guys, you mentioned this was the company. How did the company get started? And then walk us through how we got to here in 2024.
It's a great story. We're going to let him tell it since he's the founder and CEO.
Right. Well, we really like to think of it. I mean, it really was a group effort to get it to where it is today. But, you know, all three of us at one point worked at an aviation company back in 2010, 2011. You know, I'm not from Texas. I grew up in Ohio. I came down to start a retail charter brokerage in Texas. Through that, you know, Rob was one of my first hires there. Randall was at that company, but a different division, doing aircraft management sales. These two knew each other from high school, right? Or middle school, high school?
Yeah,
middle school. Yeah,
middle school.
I made him cool in high school.
But we all knew we got along. We all, you know, were very good at our respective roles, and then, you know, We all sort of left around the same time, or made a change around the same time. I don't want to say we all left, because we retained a very good relationship with that previous company's ownership. We just kind of set off on our own. I went first in 2014, you know, just put up a flag, started operations. Rob came a few months after that to really get the charter side of it rolling. It was not even a year after that, I think, Randall came on, and he was already doing aircraft sales at that point. So really at that point, that would have been 2016 is when we got the band back together, so to speak. And at that point we had charter and aircraft sales going. I think just because we had such a good reputation in the industry, a good network, you know, people went out of the way to help us get off the ground. We got off to a very, very good and quick start. Again, going back to that relationship, you know, we all like to part ways respectfully, you know, on good terms. So in 2017, we went back to that previous company, you know, and came to a mutual agreement on how our company was going to acquire, you know, the company we came from. So at that point is when we became operational. We became an FAA certified air carrier, and we started managing and flying jets of our own.
So it's pretty cool. The company we all left later, we got to buy. Yeah. So, and we had that opportunity to hit on what Lewis said is that relationship with that owner of that company remains incredibly strong today, and is in fact a close friend of ours, and we still, you know, talk to him on a weekly basis. So,
how does this is a very fragmented business, like we said, you're mm-hmm. competing in a business that could just have one person, a cell phone, and a laptop. Price, you know, is something that's already a lot of people are price sensitive to. You can always be undercut. Talk to us about how you guys thought about growing the business and growing in this really competitive space to stand out, right? What did you guys do from a growth standpoint?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we like to hit on this a lot because, again, a lot of it is so sales driven. So if you want to, you can just create a lot of sales transactions, take all the money home, spend it, and it's gone, and just do it again, repeat, repeat, mm-hmm. repeat. Since day one, we had the intentionality to build something foundational. You know, we reinvested, you know, most of the earnings right back into the company. We invested in people and managers. We wanted to build a company. We wanted to build an enterprise. We didn't just want to do sales. We didn't just want to generate some revenue, take it home and spend it. So having that mindset since day one in, you know, 2014, 2015, 2016, we got to reap the benefits, the long-term benefits of that, you know, here in 2022, 23, 24, where it's a lot more stable, a lot more long-term of an organization than you see typically in our space.
Just to add to that, I think what he said, the foundation is super important because from the beginning, a lot of the people that came to work for us still work for us to this day. We had very little turnover, and I think that's because we have a very open door environment. We're very flexible. People kind of come and go as they want as long as they get their job done, right? And we've always kind of tried to have the most positive environment as possible. And so I think that's really paid off. We've even had people in the past, grass is always greener, right? They've left and gone to some offer and they're back with us today. So we have two instances of that where someone left and we said, okay, no problem, left on good terms. Came back, hey, that's not what I thought. I want to come back. Will you have me back? Absolutely, come on, let's go.
Yeah.
So I think it's a testament to the foundation that Lewis was talking about and the fact that these companies now kind of support and feed each other. We're now seeing an exponential growth in the management company, which that's a very difficult business to grow. Mm-hmm. FAA oversight, heavy overhead, lots of, you know, professional managers that are needed because you are, it's a private jet airline. So
yeah.
We're regulated just like American is. We have, you know, inspectors that come check our airplanes and look over our maintenance personnel and make sure they're all drug tested and all these things. And that's really expensive to run. So, and then managing pilots and, mm-hmm. you know, schedules and high net worth people schedules and expectations and flat tires are 10 grand and I'm your phone's ringing in the middle of the night because the plane's down. You know, all these things are not easy to manage. And so we've got those key players in place that have really helped us turn the corner recently. So
yeah, it wouldn't be possible without having a good culture. And we were really big on culture, like we said, since day one. So everyone's there. The culture's good, attitudes are good, everyone wants to help each other. You know, we don't have this very vindictive, cutthroat sort of, you know, vibe, which you see out there, because it's a lot of money is trading hands. And we said, no, we want to have a good, positive, healthy culture.
And we're very committed to good people. I mean, you know, on Randall's team, I think there's three people that we sponsored. You know, we're currently sponsoring for them to get their visas and be in the United States full time. So, you know, they want to be here. You know, they went to university here and, you know, they want to be in this industry in the United States. So, you know, we're committed to that and helping them stay here too.
So what does the rest of 2024 have in store for both the charter market and for the sales market?
So I know at least on the charter side, we track it. There's a big industry-wide update that goes out on a weekly basis. It looks pretty good. It looks like we're trending upward again towards the back half of the year. Like I said, some of the post-COVID boom has started to right itself, but the good thing is, you know, with us having so many different segments of this industry, even if something is, you know, trending down or up or whatever, overall, you know, we're able to support each other. But charter's looking rock solid. It looks like we are seasonal, so Q3 and Q4 is very big for charter with,
sure.
You know, ski season, holiday travel, family travel, all that. if based on where we are today, we're going to have a monster Q3 and Q4. So that's really good for the charter side.
Aircraft sales is always crazy. The fourth quarter is where we make it rain.
Sure.
So and it's always been this way, and it seems like it always will be as long as there's tax benefits at the end of the year. I think last year we did 35% of our business in the fourth quarter. In December, we did a ridiculous number of transactions. I think we did 15 transactions or 20 in the fourth quarter, or in December alone, I think. This year, our goal is like 50 transactions for the year, and we'll probably do 30 of those in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
So I think this year it may even be more skewed because of this whole thing of let's sit on the sidelines and wait. And I think that at the end of this year, people are realizing that values aren't just falling and the world's not ending. And a lot of those people on the sidelines are all going to come out of the woodwork and they're all going to buy in November and December. I hope that's the case because I would say that things have been a little bit slower this year than they were last year. Mm-hmm. And so, but I believe that the aircraft sales side of the business will be very active in the third and the fourth quarter. Yeah.
Where can everybody get in touch with you guys? If they want to charter or buy or?
Yeah, so.
Give them your cell phone, Rob.
Yeah. Flash it across the
screen. No, I mean, our website, you know, we've got trip forms on there that people can go and fill out if they have certain, you know, requests that they want to put in there. It's leviateair.com.
And there's some neat tools you can play around with on the website as well. If you just want to check out different aircraft, luggage capacity, range, that sort of thing.
For you can book a charter trip at fly@leviateair.com. That's easy. Mm-hmm. So you can just email fly, and that distributes out to the entire charter team, which I think they've got 10 plus charter brokers around the country. And then if you're interested in aircraft sales, you can get in touch with me, randall@leviateair.com. So randall@leviateair.com.
Awesome. Well, this has been great, guys. Thank you so much. This is one of my favorite topics to talk about. And I think it's something that we learned a lot about just in this short amount of time. And appreciate you guys for coming in and for taking some time out. And we hope to have you guys back, you know, as we get any new developments and innovations in the private world. Would love to have you guys back. So without further ado, again, this is the Leviateair team, and thank you guys for tuning into another episode of Kronos.